Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Make sure you stick around, because later in the episode, we'll break down today's biggest stories in the Chicago area. But first, a warning, this conversation is going to touch on sensitive issues. If you or a loved one has experienced sexual assault or abuse, please know that you're not alone. For support, you can call RAIN's National Sexual Assault Hotline at 800-656-HOPE, or you can text the word HOPE to 64673. What you wear should never be mistaken for consent, but that's exactly what sparked an international movement more than two decades ago. Today, the last Wednesday in April, is Denim Day, and it stems from an Italian Supreme Court ruling that implied a woman who wore a pair of tight jeans consented to sexual assault. That decision, of course, sparked outrage, and since then, women around the world have protested. Here in Illinois, advocates have been working on the ground to prevent sexual violence and to help survivors move forward in their lives. And they say the harm reaches far beyond the physical act itself, and that part of the fix requires a public health approach rather than just a criminal justice lens. So in this episode of The Pod, a panel of experts will share some Chicago-area efforts to assist survivors and ways that you can offer support. At the table was Jillian Fury, the clinical services supervisor at Resilience. They're a local nonprofit and rape crisis center dedicated to serving survivors of sexual violence. Megan Greason, who's a professor of psychology at DePaul University. And Laura Ng, who's a project manager at the Division on Gender-Based Violence with the Chicago Department of Family and Support Services. Megan starts us off with a look at how prevalent sexual assault and violence is here in Chicago. Here she is.
Sexual assault is incredibly prevalent. We know that for a fact. While it does affect people of all backgrounds, it's also gendered, and we find that women and non-binary and trans folks are most disproportionately impacted. We don't have perfect prevalence data for Chicago specifically, so instead we have to rely on reports to Chicago police. And so we found in the past few years, about 1,900 to 2,000 incidents have been reported each year to Chicago police. But I just need to be really clear, that's only a very small fraction of the problem, because we know that the vast majority of assaults will not be reported to police. About 23% maybe, and that's probably pretty high, probably less than that are actually reported to police. So that 1,900 to 2,000 is really just a drop in the bucket.
And Laura, I know that you crunch numbers as well for the city of Chicago. Does what Megan just laid out for us, does that track?
Absolutely. So there's a couple of public data portals that's available online. One is the Chicago Violence Reduction Dashboard, so folks can go there themselves, as well as the Chicago Data Portal, where you can put in your exact address and see within a mile radius or 2 miles, however many miles radius, of the rates of violent crime that is reported to Chicago police. And so I want to address something and put like a number to visualize this a little bit better. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that maybe, according to RAIN, 23% may be reported to police. And that means that there's over 1,500 sexual assaults that are never reported. And then if you look at the Chicago data portal, we see violent crime. We know the neighborhoods of violent crime is up in. But what's interesting in the Chicago data portal, if I look at our six community service centers, the North area location, which is in Uptown, actually has the highest percentage of criminal sexual assault happening.
On the north side?
All six, yeah.
I wonder what that tells us.
Yep. And that kind of goes into our later conversation about making this a public health issue.
Yeah. And let's get there, Jillian. We talked on the opposite lens there about sexual assault typically being treated like a criminal justice issue. It is a crime, so that makes sense, right? But talk to us more about what that means and what the process looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as you said, sexual violence has traditionally been treated as a criminal justice issue, but that approach is so limited because it focuses on what happens after the harm. And so a great deal of our clients that are coming in aren't even looking to press charges because of the rates of like success with justice being served for clients. Mm. So we know that 80 to 90% of sexual harm reports made to CPD did not even result in an arrest. So a lot of times our clients aren't necessarily looking to go through a re-traumatizing experience to try to seek justice that won't be served.
So the criminal justice approach, if I'm hearing you correctly, it's leading to ongoing issues like we're seeing under-reporting and repeated harm.
Yeah.
In some cases.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why do you think it's important that we as a society start viewing this as a public health issue, Megan?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons. Like Jillian said, the vast majority of cases are never going to reach accountability in the criminal justice system, and most people aren't going to report. So we can't keep focusing on that. But in addition to that, a public health approach is a lot more comprehensive. It's going to focus on things like mitigating the very real impact that this has on survivors, their well-being, their ability to engage in their lives, even the broader financial cost to society. But also really important to me is that it's also going to take a focus on prevention. So before we even get to the place of a crime has occurred and someone's been harmed, how do we stop sexual violence from happening before it even happens?
Anything to add, Laura?
Yeah, absolutely. And so one of the things that we do at the City of Chicago is that sexual violence is under the umbrella of gender-based violence. And so when we talk about gender-based violence, the Gender-Based Violence Task Force, which is made up of survivors and community members and agencies that are doing this work, like Resilience, they're on this task force, and that was codified several years ago. Mm-hmm. Under this current administration, it was actually moved into the Mayor's Office of Community Safety, which addresses a lot of reentry work and community violence work. And so I think the Mayor's Office of Community Safety already looks at violence as a public health concern. So moving gender-based violence under that office at the mayor's office says a lot about how we're really looking at sexual violence and the greater gender-based violence as this public health concern that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I don't know, I can say even more disturbing, sexual assault and violence, it's kind of become this social norm. And I say this because it's so normalized that you're seeing thousands of people flocking to the internet and sharing ways that they've drugged and sexually assaulted their wives on so-called online rape academy. I want to hear from all three of you on this. I mean, where do we start, Megan?
Yeah, I think one of the problems we face is that we focused a lot on awareness, and awareness is really critical. We want to teach people about what is sexual assault, what is healthy consent, and also we know that that's not sufficient because a lot of these folks do, in fact, know what they're doing. They're going online to search out ways to do this, right? Mm. So I think part of it is changing the norms that you're talking about, changing those values. But a problem with this is that there are so many negative messages out there. The research has shown that perpetrators of sexual violence tend to have broader negative attitudes, particularly towards women. And so while this happens to all genders, we do find that male violence against women tends to be associated with broad, more hostile attitudes towards women broadly. We're also seeing some negative values and norms around what it means to be a man and that men should be pursuing sex aggressively, should be using manipulation, deception, and things like this. So we need to be changing those norms and interrupting those. And as a whole community, we should get involved in interrupting those norms.
Jillian, thoughts on this becoming so normalized?
Yeah, I think it just shows how sexual violence is something that we've just been ignoring for so long, and through our avoidance of addressing this issue, we're allowing it to thrive. We're allowing it to exist in places. We're allowing it to happen. And what the CDC now finds is 1 out of 2 women, 1 out of 6 men. And we have to be able to address this culture that teaches people that they're entitled to another person's body. And that means that people have to be ready to have that conversation, that this is existing and it is so prevalent.
I see. Laura?
Oh, gosh, what is there to add to this conversation? I think it's incredibly scary. And I think, you know, we can do things in our home. We talk about prevention. So this is already happening. How do we prevent it at earlier and earlier ages? And so I think for myself, having 2 toddlers, we always teach them that this is my body. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if your DO wants to give you a hug, but you're not ready yet, it's okay. Like when you're ready, you can go give her a hug type of thing. And then at the city level, of course, we actually doubled our funding for prevention programs from the last several years to this current year, which means we were able to actually double the number of funded agencies that do prevention work. And then specifically when it comes to sexual violence, a few of those agencies include the Chicago Alliance Against Sexual Exploitation, the Salvation Army Stop It Program, which specifically addresses sex and labor trafficking, and the Power Project, which also specifically addresses sex trafficking.
Mm-hmm. You alluded earlier, Megan, to, you know, men versus women here, right? Because we know the majority of survivors in this case, in this topic, are women. Men do experience sexual assault, but in smaller reported numbers. In a 1996 article from the American Journal of Public Health, Lynn Hecht Schafrin wrote, quote, Because men have traditionally controlled the positions of power from which issues and problems are defined, it is men's definitions based on their experiences that shape the issues to which the world attends. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that's really insightful and important. We do know that, again, that this is a gendered issue that also affects people of all genders. We do care about male survivors, women survivors, non-binary survivors, right. Everyone. But we also know that this is rooted in issues of power and inequality. There's been some international work that has showed higher gender inequality more broadly is associated with higher rates of sexual violence in different countries. So the more we can provide women and other folks with access to resources, more equality, that can hopefully help move the bar and move the needle on sexual violence as well.
Speaking of resources, Jillian, tell us the services and things that folks have access to at your organization, Resilience.
Yeah, absolutely. So at Resilience, we're titled as Rape Crisis Center, but we do a lot more than just that. Of course, we provide medical advocacy. So being able to meet survivors in the hospital, provide them support and advocacy when they're receiving all of the things that happen when you go to the hospital after experiencing sexual violence. We also do prevention education, which looks like going into Chicago public schools and providing age-appropriate education on consent and boundaries and relationships. And then we also provide legal advocacy, so helping survivors navigate the court system and all that that goes into it if they do choose to pursue justice. And then we also provide trauma therapy for clients, up to 20 sessions, sometimes more, just helping them through the process of figuring out the framework of what recovery is going to look like for them.
Yeah. And Laura, you talked about the city's gender-based violence task force, but what else can you share about the type of work that Chicago is doing to address this problem?
Yeah, so I think back to when the city was really focused solely on domestic violence. We expanded our view of this overlapping violence that primarily women and girls and non-binary folks are experiencing. And we expanded our division to be inclusive of all gender-based violence. And so when we talk about sexual violence, that was actually something that we started funding, the work that amazing organizations like Resilience is doing just a few years ago. And so we're talking about funding things like emergency hotel programs, rapid rehousing, and cash assistance. All of these things, everything is so necessary. And one of the things I want to take an opportunity to share is that if you are not aware of all the services that are available for survivors, please reach out to us. One of the things that we have discovered is that, unfortunately, the community isn't aware. And so when you are in that crisis mode, if I can give one piece of resource at the very minimum is at least calling the local domestic violence hotline, which is run by the network. I unfortunately don't have their number memorized right now, but the network is who you would call to access all the resources that I just talked about.
Yeah. If you or a loved one has experienced sexual assault or abuse, for support, you can call RAIN's National Sexual Assault Hotline. That number is 800-656-HOPE, or you can text the word HOPE to 64673. Now, I want to talk about some more of the impact that a person experiences here. But something that we don't think of before we get into that, Megan, is what effect it has on their loved ones as well. Can you share what comes to mind?
Yeah. So it has obviously a very significant impact on survivors directly, but it can have what we call a vicarious or secondary effect on their loved ones. The loved ones can also go through what we consider to be traumatic stress, and that can affect them both in the short term, but also the long term.
Yeah. And the person, of course, going through it, Jillian, I mean, talk about the physical, mental, and emotional impacts.
Absolutely. So the impacts are just... you can't even imagine. It touches every single part of one's life, their relationship, their work, their sense of safety. We know that just the CDC estimates that sexual violence survivors incur around $122,000 over a lifetime in costs associated with lost wages, health, criminal justice, and property damage.
Wow.
Almost 2.9 million U.S. women have experienced a rape-related pregnancy in their lifetime.
Women. What was that number?
2.9 million.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
That's alarming.
Yeah. Roughly 12% of female rape victims contract a STI because of the assault. So it's not just the mental impacts, obviously PTSD, substance use disorder, suicide attempts. One third of women who are raped contemplate suicide and 13% attempt it. Mm. So it's not just the psychological impacts, but the ramifications of the mental health impacts result in loss of jobs, mm-hmm. loss of education, unable to work towards the things that they want in life.
Right. And a complete lifestyle change.
Devastating. Right? Yeah.
On top of the mental impacts. You've talked, Laura, about restoring a sense of agency and empowerment to survivors and how essential that is. Talk about that. And how can we do better as a society?
I think, so jumping off of some of the things that Jillian was talking about, I think about the idea of taking someone's power and control away from them, and then as the greater community, as your workplace, how do we give your power and control as much as possible in those settings? And so I think it's recognizing, educating each other in the workplace to recognize trauma when you're bringing your whole self to work, and recognizing that if somebody was previously extremely dedicated and met all of their deadlines, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, maybe they're kind of falling back on their deadlines and really diving into that, having this trauma-informed approach from supervisors and HR departments to talk about, like, hey, is there something that we need to address here? And then offering some of that flexibility of, like, do you need to work from home more often? We have amazing leave ability in the state of Illinois for employees mm-hmm. under the VESA Act. And so I'm going to look to my colleagues here to explain VESA if we need to. But I think it's about how do we as family members, as friends, as coworkers, bring folks back to a sense of power and control. And one of the things that I don't want to miss in our conversation here is also the effects of child sexual abuse. As we talk about sexual violence, I think focusing on children also has to be a part of this conversation. And so a couple of things come to mind here when we talk about giving children a sense of that power and control back. Maybe it doesn't feel as applicable, but how do we give children that sense of childhood back?
Yeah.
And allowing them the space to share about their experience, but also to be a kid. And I think it rolling with where folks are ready to move towards, be they children or adults, really is just, you know, right. Everything that I know my panelists are doing is walking alongside folks.
And VESA is the Illinois Victims Economic Security and Safety Act. That's what it spells out to be. And to your point, it allows employees who are victims of domestic, sexual, or gender violence, or if they have family or household members who are victims, to take up to 12 weeks of unpaid job-protected leave. And it also, it applies to employers with leave duration based on their company size. So very good, a very good thing to have in our pockets here in Illinois. And Megan, I know your work focuses on, as you've talked about, improving community response to gender-based violence. How can we as a community make a difference?
Yeah, I think there's several ways. When we're actually responding to sexual assault that has occurred, really restoring that autonomy to the survivor, the power of choice and control over what happens to them. That includes respecting their decisions, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than telling them or forcing them to do something they don't want to do. Who do you want to tell? Who do you not want to tell? Here's your options. How can I support you in making the choice that's best for your safety, for your well-being? So I think that's part of it. Ongoing collaboration between different groups. So whether it's rape victim advocacy, medical, legal is also critical. And we have found in research that I and others have conducted that services like the ones that Resilience and other organizations in the city provide are in fact extremely helpful in helping reduce long-term trauma symptoms because they are giving that control back and they're informing survivors and helping them protect their rights. So I think that's really critical. But we can also get involved as communities in prevention too. So having a broader, more focus on how can all of us be a part of interrupting negative norms around sexual violence, mm-hmm. all of us getting involved when we see something is another piece that the community can get involved in.
Absolutely. Just a few seconds left, Jillian, but I want to give you the last word. You know, folks are listening right now. What do you want to leave them with?
I think what I'd like to leave them with is that sexual violence, especially when it's about harm that happens in childhood or within relationships, brings up really strong emotional reactions for people. And so those reactions can actually make it harder to have like clear, productive conversations about prevention and about supporting survivors. And let's stop avoiding it, please.
Yeah. Jillian Fury is a clinical services supervisor at Resilience. Megan Greeson is with DePaul University and Laura Ng with the city's Department of Family and Support Services. Again, if you need support, Call RAIN's National Sexual Assault Hotline at 800-656-HOPE or text the word HOPE to 64673. Thank you so much, ladies.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
Time now for a look at the top stories of the day in Chicago and Illinois, from the city's newly appointed inspector general to a brand new Nutella flavor exclusively made in Chicago. At the table to help me break it all down, WBEZ's Morning Edition anchor, Claire Lane, and In the Loop senior producer, Meha Ahmed. Bad news for prospective homeowners. Home prices are rising faster in Chicago than most other places. Here's Claire with the details.
Yeah, this is especially impactful for people who just love to scan Zillow. Might be frustrating for them. I knew that was Meha. I had a feeling. But home prices rising 5 times faster than the rest of the country. The Chicago Association of Realtors is saying the median price of homes that were sold in March within city limits was up nearly 8% compared to March of last year. Crane's reporting this morning that the average price for a home in Chicago was just over $409,000. The first time this is that the median price has been more than $400,000.
Tell me you don't want more of us renters switching over to becoming homeowners without telling me you don't want us to switch over. I mean, just disheartening.
It's tough. I mean, you often hear it's a seller's market. No, it's a buyer's market. Whose market is it?
Whose market is it?
And who has just a loose $409,000 lying around?
Not I.
Well, that's the problem, too. A lot of people are paying all cash for homes. And so the competition is really, really stiff. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've had friends that have put bids well over asking and they're just getting
still not
nothing.
Getting it. Wow. And housing affordability is weighing on Governor Pritzker's mind as well. Tell us how he's approaching this issue.
Yeah, he's really focused on his build plan, making that a top agenda item. He's looking mostly at limiting local government control over the development of multi-unit housing. He's really trying to push this plan to tackle what he's calling the housing supply crisis in Illinois, using that word. But the build plan includes a package of 5 different bills, all aimed at streamlining the construction process. So some of that's through zoning reform, lowering construction costs in general, and legalizing different types of housing, so a little bit more flex there. And he's also proposing a statewide zoning law that would preempt local government control over some of these residential building projects. So he has some support. AARP and housing advocate groups say the plan will help close this gap in what we're talking about, housing availability. But opponents of the package include the Illinois Municipal League, which worries it infringes on local control, so making it too broad.
Well, I mean, what stands out to me, too, I think he is thinking deeply about this and the root causes of how we got here.
Right, and he's looking at the whole state. I mean, the Realtors Association data is looking at the city, but Pritzker has to consider Illinois as a whole, which, as we know, can be pretty rural in some areas.
So Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, in other news, he's tapped someone to replace the city's former Inspector General, Deborah Witzberg. Her last day was Friday. Remind us, what kind of things does the IG investigate, Meha?
Yeah, this is one of the most important positions in city government. It's essentially Chicago's top watchdog. So, you know, is a politician or a manager of an agency misusing their city position? Did someone accept a bribe? Is there rampant fraud in a department? The IG is looking for that kind of misconduct. And like, for example, the last thing the previous Inspector General, Deborah Witzberg, investigated, was in her latest report, found like some city employees were drinking on the job, some falsified work hours, several police officers allegedly scammed COVID relief funds. So, you know, potential corruption, fraud, waste, abuse, that's the kind
of
misconduct.
Money being spent. Yeah, remember the closet?
right?
Yes.
The old closet.
Or what Meg is referring to, the O'Hare part day party.
Yeah, yes, right, that's right, with air quotes, Claire says.
Yeah, right.
Whisberg was actually on WBEZ's Say More earlier this month. I want to play a little bit of what she had to say about leaving and what comes next for that office.
There's a lot of discussion about whether jobs like this are sprints or marathons, and they are neither. They are relay races. And I think the most responsible way to approach a job like this is as a relay race. You run as hard as you can while it's your turn to run. Mm. And once you've gained some ground, you pass the baton.
All right. So she's passing the baton to David Glockner. Who is he and what do we know?
Yeah. So he's a former federal prosecutor. So remember the ComEd bribery scandal. After ComEd admitted that it was part of this bribery scheme for years in connection with former Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan, ComEd brought in David Glockner to essentially clean house.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and interestingly, Joe Ferguson with the Civic Federation, he is the, before Deborah Whitsburg, he was the Inspector General of Chicago. He's usually a critic of Mayor Brandon Johnson, but he called the mayor's choice, quote, superb and extraordinary.
Also, he co-signs.
It is high praise from former IG Joe Ferguson, who, you know, had worked with David Glockner years ago at the U.S. Attorney's Office and said that he looked up to him. So, so he got the seal of approval from a former IG.
Well, something else interesting, too, Meha, that you brought up to me as we were going through the news headlines this morning is we've only had, what, six IGs history of the city of Chicago?
Yeah, David Glockner will be the sixth. This is not a role that goes back too far. Mm. It goes back to about 1989. So
interesting. I thought that there would have been more.
Yeah, that's what I was also surprised. I found this
I'm like,
today.
Six? That's it?
Yeah.
Right. What other stories are you following, Claire?
Well, you might find this interesting. Angel Reese is back in Chicago.
What?
Yeah, she's here. It's a preseason game.
Oh, okay.
But the Atlanta Dream are taking on the Chicago Sky tonight at Wintrust, just like old times. Maybe not. But as we know, the Sky traded Reese to Atlanta for a couple of draft picks. And last season did end kind of rough for Reese. They suspended her for a game and a half after she, as we remember, publicly called for some roster improvements. We'll say it that way.
Yes.
Although I know WBEZ Cheryl Raystout might disagree. But Reese was in a press conference with CBS on Monday, and she's playing nice so far. Mm-hmm. She is saying that it's a, quote, exciting opportunity to be back in Chicago. So we'll see how that shakes out.
She's making the media rounds. I saw her even on Michelle Obama's podcast that she has with her brother, Craig Robinson, and she had some nice words.
Yeah,
for
I mean, she says
and
she's grateful for her time here, which, you know, as many people know, Chicago is a storied sports town. So that had to
I think
have
she
left.
Loved Chicago.
Definitely.
It was just the
and
team,
the people.
The team experience was maybe unfavorable for her.
Yeah.
What other stories are you following, Meha?
This is sort of an in case you missed it story from earlier in the week. First, are you a fan of Nutella?
Oh,
sort of.
Not sure about the texture.
My kids are bigger fans than I am.
So
what's going on?
There's a new Nutella flavor. This is the first one in 60 years, and it's exclusively made in the Chicago area. So fans of Nutella can check it out. It is Nutella peanut. Nutella is from hazelnut.
Okay.
And so I guess this is a hazelnut peanut hybrid.
Okay, you see, I might be more interested now in Nutella because I'm much more of a peanut fan than a hazelnut fan.
Yeah.
But the fact that this is just a Chicago exclusive?
So this was exclusively made here. So it is made in Franklin Park. That's where their facility is. And they invested like $75 million to produce a new product.
To basically make a new peanut butter?
I mean, if you're going to put it like
that.
That's
what it sounds like.
Yes. It does sound kind of like that. But I'll try it.
Yeah,
right?
I might be more open to trying it because hazelnut was probably what was keeping me away. But of course, fascinating stuff.
this is the kind of hard hitting news.
Chicago
that I like to
always reinventing the wheel. That's WBEZ's Meha Ahmed and Claire Lane.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Micah Yasin, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.